To the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is January 6th, 2021. I am Louise Bjorkman, and I'm joined on the panel this afternoon by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jeffrey Bryan. We are here in the matter of State of Minnesota versus Colton Camacho. And counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures, and they are the same, even though we are proceeding with, by Zoom today. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You should be able to see the timing on one of the screens in your gallery view. So with that, Mr. Woodhull, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Woodhull. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Colton Camacho. Today, we're asking this court to reverse the restitution award. There's two issues in this case. The first is the Boettcher issue, identifying the legal scope of what is compensable under the restitution statute. And the second issue is more of a legal sufficiency issue, identifying the evidentiary problems, admitting inadmissible evidence at the contested restitution hearing. So I'd like to start with the Boettcher issue, which again is important because it defines the scope of what is actually compensable under the restitution statute. And Boettcher is a relatively new case, 2019 Supreme Court case that limits the scope of compensable restitution to economic losses resulting from the crime. Boettcher overruled a previous case that had a factual relationship standard, which essentially allowed a victim to recover economic loss for anything arising out of the same behavioral incident as a crime. But Boettcher significantly narrows this to economic loss resulting from the crime itself. So applying Boettcher to this case, this case is a crime of prostitution, as we identified in the brief. Prostitution is actually an inchoate offense. It criminalizes an agreement rather than any kind of discernible conduct. Most relevant here is that prostitution is very distinct from the charged and ultimately dismissed offenses of criminal sexual conduct. So reviewing the record in this case, the economic loss that the victim appears to have sustained in the form of medical bills for the treatment of a mental illness, the record at the contested restitution hearing and actually the sentencing transcripts, the court's post-sentencing order, the guilty plea itself, seem to suggest that the victim's economic loss resulted from mental illness caused by dismissed charges. And under Boettcher, economic losses resulting from dismissed or acquitted charges in the case of Boettcher, but applied to a guilty plea, dismissed charges are not recoverable under the restitution statute.
Mr. Withall, let me ask you this. Does it make a difference that when your client pleaded guilty to the prostitution offenses, he admitted having sexual contact with the three minor victims?
The factual basis supporting the conviction is absolutely relevant, but the scope of recoverable loss needs to be limited to the facts supporting the conviction itself. So to analogize Boettcher here, even though the defendant was not convicted of the arson, the district court found that there was otherwise sufficient evidence and testimony in the record to support the legal conclusion that he burned the house down. Also relevant here, to the second part to this answer is, Your Honor, it's not illegal to have sex with someone who's over the age of consent. If he admitted to engaging in sexual conduct with the victims of prostitution, that's not a crime. The charged conduct that was dismissed was sexual conduct with the fear of imminent bodily harm. So even though he admitted that he engaged in sexual conduct with the victims in this case, but that sexual conduct that he admitted to is not an admission to criminal sexual conduct because he made no admissions to the presence of coercive factors of the fear of imminent bodily harm. And there was no illegal conduct associated with the sexual contact, again, because the prostitution offense does not require a sexual act. Under the prostitution statute, the you unmuted, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, the statute talks about, you know, prohibits someone who hires or offers or agrees to hire. So, I mean, I get that that's why it can be an inchoate offense. But here where they did hire and he admits a factual basis of paying the girls for the sexual contact that you had, strikes me that that would sweep in the sexual contact into the act.
Your Honor, I think I lost the last bit of what you were saying.
Oh, I just, again, have wondered, given the fact that this was an actual hire situation where he admits that he paid the girls for the sexual contact they had after that offense, that that somehow would link it to the actual sex contact that I acknowledge is not required to establish prostitution, but was established here.
You know, that goes to when that actual crime was complete. And it also factors in, you know, what the economic loss resulted from. So the economic loss is not alleged to be the result of him offering the victims money in exchange for sex. The economic loss is alleged, or at least was asserted by the state, to be the result of this scary situation. This terrible night, as the state describes it in its brief. But that's separate and distinct from the crime of conviction here, which is this inchoate offense, this transactional crime that prohibits a criminal agreement, as opposed to the actual criminal sexual conduct that the state alleges. There's factual allegations in the complaint supporting probable cause, but that's dismissed under the agreement. And, you know, it's not that victims can never recover from dismissed charges. The state absolutely has the ability, when they're negotiating and making plea offers to the defense, to include restitution for the dismissed conduct as part of the plea agreement. And that's, I think, what strikes at the heart of this, that there's a flavor of this allowing the state to have their cake and eat it too. That I want to draw the court's attention to the district court's order that it issued on 11/13 of 2019. It's a post-sentencing order amending its earlier finding on single behavioral incident. This is relevant because the court is making findings on whether these crimes arose from a single behavioral incident. But more specifically, that order identifies the prostitution offenses arising out of the same behavioral incident as sexual assaults, but at least accurately identifying that the crime of conviction is just the prostitution. So I think this is evidence that the court is conflating the crime of conviction with the crimes alleged in the complaint and the charges that were dismissed under the agreement. You know, in support of this, I also want to highlight that.
So, Mr. Without, would you indicate for me in the restitution order where the district court is making that same, the error of conflating the defendant's crime of conviction, the prostitution, with the criminal sexual conduct? Because I don't see it in the restitution order.
The judge just, Your Honor, the district court judge just says the crime. It says that it results from the crime. So when we're talking about an abuse of discretion standard, we're talking about the record supporting the district court's findings. So reviewing the transcripts of the contested restitution hearing is probably the best source of information of what the district court relied upon to reach the conclusion that it did, which was that the economic loss resulted from the crime. The sole witness is the victim's mother. She says that the economic loss was the result of, and she said the word rape. She says as a result of the rape. She said, and then every other question for the rest of the transcripts, only about 50 pages, it's described as the incident. And what I was about to tell Your Honor, I think this leads right into it, is that defense counsel actually cites to Nelson and the factual relationship test. And the state also on pages 47 to 48 of that restitution hearing transcript says, essentially concedes, yeah, the convictions for prostitution, but look at the factual allegations and the complaint supporting the dismissed charges that he used force to accomplish the sexual act. And the other factual allegations in the complaint that, again, are only in the complaint in support of the dismissed charges and are not otherwise related or necessary to prove the elements of the crime of conviction, again, prostitution. So you're right. There's nothing in the restitution order that says I'm relying on the factual basis only related to the prostitution offense, but the record itself does not support the conclusion that the economic loss resulted from only the crime of conviction because of the way that the witness testified to the cause of the economic loss, specifically saying that it arose from the rape and the incident, which as I think it's fair to infer that that means that it's the incident as a whole. There's no delineation between the charged conduct as a whole, including the dismissed charges, from the crime of conviction that would permit the district court to reach the conclusion that the economic loss resulted solely from the crime of conviction.
Taking you back for a minute to the common practice of negotiating in your plea what restitution is going to be tied to and including in that dismissed or uncharged conduct, is there any indication in this record that there was bargaining and that the parties did not reach any decision? Or do we have a situation where we're looking back at it and it's just merely silent?
No, it's not silent at all, Your Honor. I mean, look at the comments from the court at sentencing, essentially saying, I don't know what happens with these negotiations. You also see at some point in the record that the state attempts to withdraw from the agreement for some reason. And the fact that the state dismissed half a dozen charges for criminal sexual conduct in exchange for his guilty plea to prostitution, which again, a completely different crime. So it's pretty evident from the record here that this plea was the product of a negotiation, maybe that didn't include express sentencing terms, but certainly included a substantial benefit to Mr. Camacho in dismissing these far more serious
charges. I understand that. I see that. And I don't think you very often have charges like this that then result in a plea to prostitution. The question I have is specific to restitution. Is there any indication that that was negotiated, or was that something that appears to be silent given what we can see in our record?
There doesn't appear to be anything from the record to show that restitution was an included term of the agreement. And I think in support of that conclusion, I would point to defense counsel's request at sentencing to close restitution at sentencing and the court actually holding it open for an additional 30 days. So that indicates that there was no agreement because they, couldn't even agree at sentencing as to whether to hold restitution open. It was not a term. Only the crimes of conviction appeared to be negotiated as part of the agreement. I should speak to the second issue, unless Your Honors have additional questions on the Betcher issue, though I acknowledge that the two issues are somewhat interrelated. And the second issue really focuses on what kind of evidence needs to be presented at a contested restitution on the issue of causation. When we're talking about the economic loss resulting from the treatment of a medical diagnosis, the issue of causation is not as apparent as it would be if there were a property crime and the victim was seeking to recover the value of property, or a physical injury that is the result of an element of the offense. So for example, in a homicide, an element of the offense is that the defendant has often caused the victim's death. That issue is no longer on the table. But in a case here where causation or the actual harm is separate and distinct from the elements of the crime or the factual basis supporting those elements of the crime, the state has additional things that it needs to prove because it was not necessarily proven at trial or through the defendant's waiver of the trial and admission of guilt. So in a case like this,
I take it the gist of your argument here is that if there's some sort of medical need that needs to be addressed, there needs to be medical evidence submitted linking that to the offense. Is that your position, that if there'd been a therapist report that says, I'm treating this person and it's as a direct result of the trauma she experienced, blah, 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 that's the heart of your argument in terms of the evidentiary insufficiency, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially, Your Honor. And I'm glad that you identified a therapist report, because a therapist wouldn't even need to necessarily come in to identify what was being treated, because the rules of evidence expressly authorize a therapist that keeps records of what they're treating and what the cause of that medical issue is as part of their business records, and need only submit an affidavit swearing that it's a true and accurate, you know, essentially the requirements of a records custodian under 8036. But that's not present here today. The mother's not competent to testify to a medical diagnosis or its cause. It's clear that the mother took the victim to a number of medical appointments. But as evidence from the record here, she's submitted every single medical bill for 3 years, including things that the district court acknowledged were plainly unrelated to even the behavioral incident under the incorrect factual relationship test, let alone the offense of conviction. I see that my time is up. I'll ask for my relief and rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, Mr. Kulk, you may proceed.
Okay, I apologize. Thank you, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Dan Kulk. I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Essentially what this comes down to, Your Honors, is the appellant is essentially wants the court to believe that the district court judge in this case relied on essentially the rape and the unconvicted allegations. However, the appellant really presents no direct evidence of this. The only evidence that really the appellant can point to is the fact that these the witness, the mother of the victim in this matter, used the word rape when she testified as to, the reasons that she was suffering these traumatic experiences and needing therapy and things of that nature. But of course, I mean, it should go without saying that a mother of a victim should not be expected to know the legal intricacies of restitution law. What the mom testified to, what Ms. Buechner testified to, is what she saw. She was told that all of these things happen. And of course, rape is the most significant and most traumatic thing. It's natural for her to focus on that. It's natural for her to use that word. What's interesting is the court never uses that. The court, who obviously understands restitution law and the fact that the restitution order needs to be linked to the convicted crime, says crime. It doesn't say rape. So the mom, again, should not be expected to know those differences. All she knows is that her daughter, the victim in this matter, throughout 2017 and into 18, spiraled and really out of control. And those were personal observations that she made up until including the point where she thought she would be better off dead. And that's what the mom testified to. Yes, she used the word rape, but that does not somehow hinge this restitution order to the rape charge. It's the word that she used. And Your Honors, there's three assumptions that essentially need to be taken for granted as true to grant the appellant's relief in here. And the first is that there actually was, in fact, an agreement for hire. The appellant, under the Betcher standard that appellant is talking about, essentially that once the crime is perfected, and in this case, i.e. the agreement to hire happens, that essentially at that time, that's it. Nothing can be recovered for things that happen subsequent to that. But as I pointed out in my brief, there's no evidence that there was an actual agreement. The only evidence that there's any agreement whatsoever is a very leading question that the appellant's attorney asked him at the plea hearing. He says, prior to picking the girls up, you made an agreement to hire them for sex. So I'm sort of paraphrasing. And then he ends it, correct. And the appellant never answers to the affirmative. The only thing that the appellant says is there's a conversation held off the record, and then they come back on to the record, and then his attorney says, you eventually gave them money, did you not? And then he said, eventually, yes. So the only thing that he really admitted to was giving them money and having a sexual contact with the victim. So not only do we not have an expressed agreement that he hired, we don't know when that agreement was perfected, if there was one, i.e. was it when he gave them the money at the end of the night, essentially, which is what they testify at the end of the night, basically dropping them off, you throw some cash at them. So, and that's the only thing that he admits to is that he gave them money after the fact. And so he never says that he agreed on a price before he picked them up. So that is an assumption right off the bat that I think needs to be made for the appellant's argument to hold water here. That's the second assumption, is that the timeline of when that agreement, if ever, was actually made to perfect that, because this was eventually ultimately done via Alford. So he never actually really does, at the plea hearing, admit to anything. And then the third assumption is...
Let me interrupt you there, because let's assume that we had a pure Alford plea, where the only admission is that the state would prove, you know, a litany of things, and that the jury would find that person guilty. And let's assume then that there's a restitution hearing. What is it that the state would have to prove at the restitution hearing? Is the state also having to prove that the crime occurred and that the injury is directly related to whatever crime the state can prove?
I think in that particular scenario, it's a little odd, because we have essentially an Alford and a semi-admission here, because I think the plea kind of went in that direction. Your Honor, if I apologize, if I could ask you to ask the questioning.
My question is, if you have a pure Alford and then you have a restitution dispute, what is it that the state has to prove at the restitution? Are they having to prove the elements of the offense again, or is it enough that you have the Alford and all they're showing is this direct link to the crime that everybody agrees in the Alford plea was admitted to?
I don't think that the state would have to prove elements of a crime at a restitution hearing. I think you would have to go with what the record reflects at the time that the restitution happens. So if it is an all Alford plea, I think you would have to go based on that. I don't think that you would have to
assume that that's true in this case. What is it that the state put forward as proof of what crime at the Alford plea stage?
So if this was a pure Alford, I suppose the evidence that would have been if he would
have
answered.
I thought you were saying this was an Alford plea.
Well, yes, it was, and okay. I understand what you're saying now. I mean, yes.
It that the state put forward to support the crime of conviction here? Because you stated in your brief, you stated in the oral argument that the crime of conviction isn't hiring somebody. So what is the crime, and what was the evidence that the state relied on?
The state relied on the complaint, which was based on, I would imagine the police reports, which was based on the victim's written reports that indicated there was, I believe, money exchanged at the end. And and I believe that would really have been it if it was pure.
It seems to me that in your brief, pages 11 and 10 to 11, you quote from the portion where the court is asking the defendant to agree the jury would find him guilty of something. And it looks like the court says, you'd agree it was an exchange for the sexual conduct, that's what you gave the money for. And then you would agree this, if this case went to trial, the jury would find that you gave them money in exchange for the sex, right?
Right.
Are you saying that the crime here was sexual conduct based on that question and answer?
No, Your Honor. What I am saying is, based on what he was convicted of. And I believe it's a valid conviction, and he was convicted of prostitution and not criminal sexual conduct, obviously. But what I am saying is that the crime, there's not necessarily direct evidence that agreement actually happened. However, it was convicted because the appellant agreed that if it went to trial, he would be convicted of it. I don't know if that answers your question, but I want to talk just real quickly about not just only the Betcher issue, but the third assumption that I think the appellant makes here is that the child is not a victim, but simply a party to a transaction. And I'll jump to that. You know, Your Honors, there's recently across the country, we have been de-victimizing so-called prostitutes. I hesitate to use that word in this particular sense, but because there is an understanding now that regardless of the situation, prostitutes, as in the legal definition, are victims of some sort. So, and the legislature has manifested this concern and this protections throughout its throughout the laws that we have. And you think about hiring an adult is a misdemeanor, hiring an adult in a public place is a gross misdemeanor, and hiring a child anywhere is a felony. And there's so much, I think what led to this, the safe harbor and this decriminalizing the prostitute is that there is an extremely heightened understanding that women and children who engage, even if it seems willingly in prostitution, are at high risk for post-traumatic stress disorder, other comorbid disorders.
I want to stop and ask a question. Assuming that, you know, I don't disagree that a victim of soliciting a minor for prostitution can suffer an injury simply because of the fact that there's an agreement to exchange sex for money that may or may not be played out. Don't we need to have an expert that would tie in this particular case the issues that child number two has had to the fact that she engaged in a prostitution offense?
I don't know that we would need an expert in this, Your Honor. And which kind of slides into the evidentiary issue. I think, you know, the legislative committee has certainly wanted to lighten the foundational requirements, especially as it pertains to 8036. And I think that is in essentially to help protect and not re-traumatize victims, especially in cases like this, to have expert, and you know, there's insinuations that the appellant thought that the victim should testify, which I can't even imagine the chilling effect that would be to have any victim seek restitution. But I think, like I said at the beginning, the mom who testified was there every day, took her to all her appointments. She was in the best position to indicate how these things happened. She was able to direct the court to, you know, at timelines of when her condition decompensated. So I don't think in this particular case, Your Honor, no. I think that was sufficient. And I will notice,
let me ask you a bit about the mother's personal knowledge. You referred right now to the office visits, but the mother also testified about a particular emergency room visit relating to the victim number two, as we call her, victim number two's suicide attempt. So if you'd explain for me what you see as the sufficiency of that evidence to prove the restitution award related to the emergency room visit, I'd appreciate that. Thanks.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the emergency room visit that really culminated, I believe, if memory serves, it was October of 2017. And it's my understanding, based on the transcript, that the mom, Christine, in this particular case, took her when she committed suicide, right? She didn't commit suicide, rather, but attempted suicide. It's my understanding that, based on her knowledge and her conversations with the victim, that the reason that she did commit suicide was a result of this traumatic event, and the conviction, yes, of the hiring to engage in prostitution, and not necessarily the rape. He wasn't convicted of that, but the whole thing is so factually intertwined that I don't know the court really could try to extrapolate what trauma is from one crime and what is from a dismissed crime. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Withall, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Bryan, to answer your question about what the state needs to prove at the contested restitution hearing, restitution is an extension of sentencing. So just like in this argument today, we're making the presumption that the conviction is valid. What the court can look at is obviously the factual basis created at the guilty plea hearing, but it's also common practice on review to review the factual allegations in the complaint. So to identify when the crime was completed in this case, the victims, at least what the complaint says, victims say that before any sexual conduct occurred, he offered them money. Mr. Camacho offered them money in exchange for sex. And according to the complaint, the victims actually rejected that. Whether they accepted it or rejected it is actually not relevant to the issue of guilt, because the crime says that, or the statute says that, the crime of prostitution is complete by offering money in exchange for sex. And also the age of the victim is an element of that offense as well. Your Honor, do you have a question?
I do. It is an interesting plea transcript, but we do have Mr. Camacho actually making some admissions about the sequence of events, right? It isn't simply an acknowledgement of what a jury could conclude. I mean, at least that's the way I read it. I can give you specific pages if you'd like, but did you see the same?
Yeah, and Your Honor, Mr. Camacho pled guilty to several district court files that day.
Yes, I'm talking just about his admissions with regard to the three victims, right?
He made direct statements about what he did that makes him guilty. Yeah. He made some weird comments about God in the transcripts and morality that I don't quite understand. But I think
I guess I didn't finish my thought. What I was trying to say is, when the district court is making decisions about restitution, specifically under the Boettcher standard, it can certainly go back and refer to the evidence that was taken at the plea hearing, right?
I think that the court could, but I don't think the court did in this case, because the transcripts weren't available to the court until after we filed the notice of appeal and order.
But we have the same judge, and you know, we assume that the judge had some awareness. Right. And
at a memory notes,
perhaps, as well, to listen to an audio recording. So
the court can do that as well if it's available to the district court. Yeah, I acknowledge that.
Right. It's in the record for us, and everyone here has asked us to look at the statements that were made at the plea hearing.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's all. I didn't see that as controversial, but I just wanted to to follow up. Thanks.
Mr. Withall, if I could direct your attention to kind of where we were at the end of respondent's argument there. And I don't like hypotheticals very much, but I'll use one here. Let's say that the victim in Boettcher incurred some expenses due to therapy. What is it that you think would have had to be presented at a restitution hearing? Is the therapist himself or herself required to tie the expense to either arson or burglary?
prostitution or criminal sexual conduct, Your Honor?
Right, but again, in our hypothetical, it's a little easier to distinguish arson and burglary. So I'm just saying, following Boettcher, if you want to make it about this case in particular, that's fine too. I just thought
the only reason I want to make it about this. The only reason I want to make it about this case is because arson and burglary, it's a property damage and it's a valuation of the property, and a mental illness is an intangible thing that, according to the cases that I cited, the Smith case and the older case from the 70s, I identified in the brief that medical diagnosis is not the subject of something that can be established through lay opinion. It requires expert opinion testimony. And if a therapist said in a report or came in at the restitution hearing and testified, you know, the rape was traumatic to her, but also just being offered money in exchange for sex was also traumatizing. I think that probably would have been sufficient to say that the therapy or the medical expenses resulted from the crime of conviction. But because there's actually no testimony that the offer of money in exchange for sex contributed to the medical diagnosis or the need for treatment, and actually all the evidence tends to show to the completed sex act that was, again, dismissed, that doesn't support the conclusion that the economic loss resulted from the crime of conviction. That's why we're asking Your Honors to reverse the district court's restitution order.
All right, thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. We will now recess pending the commencement of the 2:40 p.m. oral argument.
Thank you.